Good morning. On today's programme, celebrations in Georgia as the EU opens membership talks and the invasion of Canadian super pigs. But first we go to Turkey, where President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has managed to reset relations with Greece. The two neighbouring states have had an up-and-down relationship, but this time there's reason to believe that the two leaders want to get along. From Ankara, Jasper Mortimer reports.
Something has happened between Greece and Turkey that last year would have been impossible. In May 2022, the Prime Minister of Greece, Kyriakos Mitsotakis, addressed a joint session of the US Congress. In so many words, he told America not to sell Turkey the F-16 fighter bombers it was trying to buy. The remark infuriated Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. He said, "Mitsotakis does not exist for me." But 10 days ago, Erdogan flew to Athens, held talks with Mitsotakis that lasted twice as long as scheduled, and spoke to the media of "my friend Kyriakos." For his part, Mitsotakis addressed his counterpart as "dear Tayyip" and announced that Turks could in future visit the Greek islands without visas. During the visit, Erdogan and Mitsotakis signed 15 minor agreements, the most important of which had to do with the lifting of visas for Turks going to the Aegean Islands and the building of a new bridge over the river that forms the border between Greece and Turkey. A columnist in the Greek newspaper Katamarini said, "No issue was resolved." There are serious differences between Greece and Turkey. Over Cyprus, where Turkey has occupied the northern third of the island for 49 years, over the border in the Aegean, where Greece accuses Turkish warplanes of violating its airspace, over the rights of 150,000 Greek citizens who speak Turkish, and over drilling for gas in the eastern Mediterranean, where Turkish and Greek warships collided 3 years ago. All these issues were discussed, but not one was settled. Instead, the two leaders signed a framework for argument, called the Declaration on Good Neighborly Relations. It's an attempt to confine their disputes to diplomacy. One clause says the two countries are committed to refrain from any statement or act likely to endanger peace and stability in their region. And Erdogan went out of his way to reinforce this in the press conference. "There is no problem that cannot be solved between us," he said, "as long as we act with goodwill, focus on the big picture, and not be among those who cross the sea and drown in the current." Everybody's asking, for how long will this beautiful atmosphere last? What gives rise to hope is that current events make it advantageous for Athens and Ankara to get along. What turned relations around after Erdogan said Mitsotakis didn't exist was the Greek Prime Minister's decision to send a team of rescue workers to Turkey after its devastating earthquake in February. Then, in July, Turkey sent firefighting aircraft to Rhodes, where the burning forest had caused a state of emergency. Greece and Turkey suffer natural disasters every other year, and rapid assistance does help. Erdogan knows that if Mitsotakis is a friend, the US Senate is more likely to approve the sale of 40 fighter bombers to Turkey. Mitsotakis knows that if Erdogan is a friend, the Turkish Coast Guard will be more active in stopping migrants crossing to the Greek islands, and the Turkish Air Force will be more respectful of Greek airspace. Greek newspapers report that since the earthquake diplomacy of February, the number of airspace violations has plummeted. An interesting footnote to the summit is that Mitsotakis is related to Eleftherios Venizelos, the Prime Minister of Greece who made peace with Ataturk in 1930, 8 years after the two countries had been at war. Venizelos was a democrat. Ataturk was not. But the détente they forged endured many years. It was appropriate that Mitsotakis told the press, "History and geography decided that we live in the same neighborhood. The conjuncture sometimes brought us face to face. I know that there are voices in Turkey and Greece that oppose this new rapprochement. However, I believe that it is our historical duty to seize this opportunity." For World Report, this is Jasper Mortimer in Ankara.
To Georgia next, where thousands of people took to the streets of the capital, Tbilisi, on Friday to celebrate the announcement that the EU had granted the country candidate status at the summit on Thursday. But as Isabel Conway reports, the road to EU membership for the people is dominated by the shadow of Russian influence.
Well-fed, friendly street dogs wandered through Rustaveli Avenue, a wide boulevard reminiscent of Soviet domination, when tanks and military would triumphantly parade along the centre of Tbilisi, capital of Georgia. I stopped to admire a retriever cross who's curled up on a large blue flag that blew off its moorings from one of the poles flying the bright blue starry symbol of European unity before the impressive Parliament building. A sea of Euro flags started appearing throughout the city. Georgia applied for EU membership, together with Ukraine and Moldova, days after Russia invaded Ukraine. But few believed its chances to be considered to join the fold would come so soon. It was difficult to prove to the world that Russia's invasion of Georgia in 2008 was unprovoked, when they took two of our provinces until the Ukraine war, says anthropologist Irakli Pipia. For millennia, Georgia has seen civil conflicts even in the post-Soviet period. A five-day war with Russia in 2008 saw Russian tanks come within 35 kilometres of Tbilisi before an EU-brokered ceasefire halted hostilities. Russia has been a major security threat to Georgia's independence and sovereignty for years, occupying 20% of the country's territory, and the war in Ukraine has not stopped it from further flexing a muscle. Last month, Russian occupation forces in the annexed region of Gori in South Ossetia, only an hour and a half away by road from Tbilisi, shot dead a Georgian citizen and captured a second man, whom they accused of resisting arrest whilst trespassing on foreign soil. According to news reports, the victim was collecting apples from his orchard on land recently fenced off and seized by the occupiers when he was killed. Condemning the murder and calling for the release of the second man, Georgia's pro-European president, Salome Zurbachile, has been the catalyst pushing for the country's EU candidacy, cementing her long-standing close ties with Brussels as a former diplomat. She has been largely unsupported by the ruling government, who had backed her as president in 2018. Now, some of its members are accusing her of overstepping her powers. Though some in government are seen as under Russian influence, despite their denials, they know the vast majority of Georgia's population looks towards EU membership for Georgia's future stability and prosperity, and NATO membership for safe peace of mind. Concerns remain over democratic backsliding by Georgia's ruling government party, and prolonged political polarisation has cast doubt over the commitment of the country's political elite to democratic governance and the rule of law. Democracy in Georgia, while not yet dead, is in intensive care. Amanda Paul, senior policy analyst of the Europe in the World programme, who's an expert on issues related to security and conflict resolution in the region, has warned. Other observers also question whether Georgia's leaders are genuine, and opposition parties accuse them of being under Kremlin influence, with shadowy oligarchs pulling the strings in the wings. As usual, nothing is straightforward in Georgia. Former President Mikhail Saakashvili, jailed for alleged abuse of power during his time in office, could be a ticking time bomb also. His deteriorating health in prison has left him on the brink of death. He claims he was poisoned. The government insists his poor health results from an ongoing hunger strike and failure to take his medication. Should he die in jail, widespread protests like those that erupted this summer, forcing the government to abandon a proposed law critics said would shut down or discredit organisations critical of them, are anticipated. Meanwhile, a dream of EU membership is keeping Georgia's population ever hopeful. Elvira, who speaks four languages and manages a souvenir shop in Tbilisi, smiles gently. We may not share a border with the EU, but we are a European country. Georgians are European, she says. For World Report, this is Isabel Conway in Tbilisi, Georgia.
Across the Atlantic now, and parts of the United States are under the threat of a new invasion. And it's coming from Canada. Feral super pigs could soon be crossing the border. The wild pigs have been roaming through Alberta, Saskatchewan and Manitoba and are now threatening to spill across the prairie border. And as we hear from Dan Karpinchuk, the pigs are difficult to contain or even eradicate.
Researchers say these super pigs are smart, tough and adaptable. They eat and damage crops, eat wildlife and can spread disease to working hog farms. One researcher describes them as the most invasive animal on the planet. The U.S. isn't a stranger to these wild pigs. They've been around for years and have been found in more than 30 states. Pigs are not native to North America, but they've been here for centuries. In Canada, the problem goes back to the 1980s, when farmers were encouraged to raise wild boar. Many believe there would be a market for them in Canada as exotic livestock and a ready source of cash for meat. After all, men have hunted wild boar for food for thousands of years. The idea was to diversify Canadian livestock production and even have the boar used as game. But that market collapsed by 2001, and many farmers simply set the animals free. Many also escaped. That was the mistake. The boar crossbred with domestic swine and created the super pig that's now spreading out of control in Saskatchewan, Alberta, and Manitoba. They have the survival skills of wild Eurasian boar, as well as the high fertility of domestic swine. A professor at the University of Saskatchewan, Ryan Brook, calls them an ecological train wreck. It seems they're very adaptable and can easily survive the Canadian winter, much to the surprise of many experts. These hybrids also reproduce quickly, making them one of the most prolific invasive mammals in Canada. Scientists say by 2017 the wild pigs had spread across much of Canada, from British Columbia to Ontario and Quebec. Most of them, however, are in southern Saskatchewan. Over the past 10 years, their territory has increased by more than 85,000 square kilometers a year. Researchers say a male wild pig can have a territory as large as 300 square kilometers in the summer. And since they breed so rapidly, researchers like Ryan Brook say 65% of a wild pig population could be destroyed every year and it will still increase in size. He adds that the success rate for hunters is only about 2-3%. Some U.S. states have banned the hunting of the pigs because it makes them more cautious and nocturnal, thereby making them more difficult to track and kill. There is a trapping incentive program which offers trappers $75 per set of pigs' ears. The program has been running from early 2022 and will end in March of next year. And they eat anything, including crops and wildlife, often tearing up land as they root for bugs and crops. They're also threatening native species such as nesting birds, deer, and farm livestock. And they can spread diseases such as African swine fever to hog farms. They range in size from about 3.5 to 5 feet in length and can weigh as much as 400 pounds. Officials say it's no longer possible to eradicate the wild pigs in Manitoba and Saskatchewan. There have been 62,000 documented wild pig sightings in Canada. This explosion of super pigs in western Canada is now approaching the U.S. border. Some aerial reconnaissance has already spotted them on the other side of the border in North Dakota. But feral swine have already been reported in at least 35 U.S. states, and the U.S. Department of Agriculture estimates their population at about 6 million. They've already caused about $2.5 billion in damage to U.S. crops every year, mostly in the South. Some states have been successful in holding them back, mainly by using a detection system that finds them early and fast, and by responding quickly to eradicate them. The states now being threatened by the current invasion are Minnesota, North Dakota, and Montana, and they're already taking measures to stop it. Ryan Brook says these states need to use every available tool they have if they're serious about keeping out the wild pigs. There's already a ban on raising and transporting them. Now under consideration are large ground traps or shooting them from helicopters, as well as tracking programs. Minnesota's Department of Natural Resources is expected to recommend new prevention steps in February, and the Federal Agriculture Department is using aircraft and drones for northern border surveillance. As one researcher put it, the issue of the wild pigs has become so acute, it's gone from a minor nuisance to an out-of-control problem incredibly fast. For World Report, I'm Dan Karpinchuk in Toronto.
Well, that's it from World Report for today. The programme was edited by Elaine Devlin. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/worldreport or wherever you get your podcasts. We're back again at the same time next week. Until then, from myself, Justin McCarthy, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.